two studies this afternoon and tonight, I want to look at two subjects, both of which start in the Law of Moses and finish in the New Testament. I'm sure that the Old Testament is very largely neglected, mainly because it doesn't look terribly interesting on the surface. It's a lot of the books such as Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy and books of that nature don't strike us as being all that interesting, and sometimes they don't even look as if they're very relevant to us. I think they're very relevant, not because we're under the law of Moses. We aren't under the law of Moses. The law of Moses was given for a specific people, the people of Israel, that God brought out of Egypt and that he was taking to Canaan, and they were the laws, it was the code of legislation under which they were to live their lives. And so there's lots of instruction here for magistrates concerning penalties and offences and how they were to live with each other. Nevertheless, those laws were based on principles of behaviour and morality, which I believe are relevant at all times and in all societies. And I think as we read the Old Testament together, we can learn from it, just as we can learn from some of the experiences of God's people in Old Testament times. We can learn from the Psalms. Now, we weren't running away from Saul as David was, but yet we read David's Psalms and we can see meaning in them for ourselves. Well, it's the same with the Law of Moses. We can read some of these pieces of legislation. I believe we can find meaning in it for ourselves, and as we see the underlying principles, we can follow those through as they apply to us now. As we develop it through the Old Testament into the New Testament, I think we'll find that there are some very interesting things. First of all, we're going to speak on the subject of debts, as I mentioned previously, debts. We're going to read from Leviticus 25, just a few verses beginning at verse 35. And if your brother becomes poor and cannot maintain himself with you, you shall maintain him. As a stranger and a sojourner, he shall live with you. Take no interest from him or increase, that is, interest on his money or on the money you lent him. But fear your God, and that your brother may live beside you. You shall not lend him your money at interest, nor give him your food for profit. I am the Lord your God, who brought you forth out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God. Now if your brother becomes poor beside you and sells himself to you, you shall not make him serve as a slave. He shall be with you as a hired servant and as a sojourner. Let's leave it at that for just now. I think you can see from that that God looked upon the Israelites, and they were to look upon themselves as being one big family. And therefore, they were not to take advantage of each other when somebody got into difficulties. As a result, they are told that they can lend to each other, lend to a person in need, but they were not to take interest. That is, they were not to cash in on this chap's misfortune, but were to help him through his difficulty. We're told also that if the person wished, that is, the man who's giving the money, even though he wasn't to take interest, if he wished, he could take some sort of guarantee, some sort of pledge, as an assurance that he might sometime get his money back. But even in that case, there were some very strict laws controlling the things he could take and the things he couldn't take. For example, it says, no man shall take a mill, that is a millstone, particularly an upper millstone, in pledge. That's in Deuteronomy, because obviously the person would have no way of grinding the corn to get his flour to make his food. You'd be depriving the person of a very important part of his ordinary way of life to keep himself going. We're told also that when you make your neighbour a loan of any sort, you shall not go into his house to fetch the pledge. You shall stand outside, and the man to whom you make the loan shall bring the pledge out to you. So you couldn't come the heavy on him by saying, right, I've given him this money and he's a bit slack in getting it back to me, I'm going to barge into his house and steal his tape recorder or seize something out of his house, because I think that's worth the amount of money. No, you had to respect the man's right. That's his house, you stay outside. And if you want to make some sort of demand on his pledge, you don't violate his private property. You stand outside, you call out, and he can come out and give it to you. Again, you see, protecting the person who's vulnerable. And the law of Moses was very strong in protecting those who are vulnerable against exploitation from people who had power and influence. And then it goes on to talk about the man's coat. You could take perhaps his coat as a pledge, but if you did, you had to give it back to him each night before he went to bed, because it was probably the only piece of warm clothing he had, and the poor chap would have to sleep in the cold otherwise. So it says, if he's a poor man, you shall not sleep in his pledge. And when the sun goes down, you shall restore to him the pledge, that he may sleep in his cloak. and bless you. So there's another thing. They couldn't take an essential item of clothing. You read on further, you find that they were not allowed to take land in payment for debts. They couldn't seize a man's property. That's because the property was looked upon as an inheritance, which was part of him, so to speak, and you could not sell the person into debt and then take property from him in repayment. Now that, of course, is what happens all over the world. That's why the third world countries are crying out for land reform, because the rich gobble up the poor, gobble up their possessions, and eventually seize their land. And of course, who owns the land? He owns the country. Now, there was a provision against that happening in Israel, and of course there was a provision, as you know, in the law of Moses to say that any land that had exchanged hands over the previous number of years, when every 50th year came around, it was restored to the original owner in order to maintain the balance that God had arranged when the division of the land was first made under Joshua. Another thing we noticed, that if the person got himself into debt, then you could give him employment, and so he could work off his debt in wages, so to speak. He could pay his way out through working for you, when you wrote off his labour as repayment, but you could not make him a slave. We just read that a moment ago. All these provisions were there so that the people could help each other, but they were not to take advantage of each other. Well, human nature is a very consistent commodity, and you find that as you move on in the story, each took advantage of the other. You get on into the history of Israel and you read some of the things that happened, and very soon you find that debtors were taking advantage of creditors, and sometimes creditors were taking advantage of debtors. Now let's look at the first one, the debtors taking advantage of the creditors. What was happening here was that a person would get himself into debt, and then he'd go to some chap who looked an honest, supportive type of person, and he'd say, look, would you go guarantor for me and help me through? And the kind, soft-hearted chap would say, yes, I'll stand guarantor for you, because I know you're in quite a problem, and so I'll sort of look after you. And then the next thing you know, after he's gone guarantor for this chap's debts, the chap scarpers and leaves him carrying the baby, so to speak. By the time you get to the book of Proverbs, that was obviously a very grave social problem in Israel, and it's mentioned about half a dozen times in the book of Proverbs. Listen to this one. The man's giving some wise instruction, because he knows that sometimes you can go pledge for another person, you can guarantee another person, and then get caught in an awful mix. He says, my son, if you have become surety for your neighbour, and you've given your pledge for a stranger, and you get snared in the utterance of your lips, you get caught in the words of your mouth, then do this, my son. Save yourself, because you have come into your neighbour's power. So hasten, go to your neighbour. Give your eyes no sleep, give your eyelids no slumber. Save yourself like a gazelle from the hunter, like a bird from the hand of the fowler. Get yourself out of it, he says, before you find yourself really caught properly. Later on he says, he who gives surety for a stranger will smart for it, and he who hates suretyship is secure. Later on, another one. Be not one of those who gives pledges, who becomes surety for debts. Because very soon you'll find you're carrying the whole lot, and the other fellow's absconded, and there you are looking pretty stupid. It's obvious that there were some pretty rough characters around. Con men, we'd call them today, wouldn't we? Con men, the sort of fellow that gets into a church, and he's got a soft line, and he puts over a sob story, and before long, you know, he's conned a few people into giving him some money, and after 3 or 4 weeks, he's made his pile, and off he's gone somewhere else. I think a lot of us have had experience with characters like that. That's what he's talking about. But the major problem in Israel was the other way around. The major problem was the creditors taking advantage of the debtors. People getting themselves into problems, and then those who lent them the money leaning on them and really making life difficult. When you come to the minor prophets, you find it's a very common theme. For example, Amos says something like this. He says, woe to you who trample the head of the poor into the dust of the earth, and who would sell the righteous for a pair of shoes. You'd sell a person into slavery for a debt as paltry as a pair of sandals. And then he goes on in the next couple of verses to say, and woe to you also who take the clothes in pledge. You take clothes in pledge, and then you make a bed out of them and lie down beside these altars and commit adultery with these ritual prostitutes that were available at these Baal high places. The very things that they were told not to do. They had no need of those people's clothing. I mean, what does a rich man want with a poor man's clothes? But they'd taken the clothes in pledge. They had no need to wear them, but they made a very nice bed. And then they used the bed for their illicit sex with these prostitutes. Later on, you find a couple of chapters further over, Amos has a word to say to them about the fact that they take exactions of wheat. Now, that's another thing we saw they weren't supposed to do. They weren't supposed to take the people's daily food or what they had to make their daily food. Once again, there it is. You go to the book of Micah. In the book of Micah, you find the same sort of thing, where he says that these rich people, they go to bed at night, and then they lie in their beds, and they hatch up plots. He says they work evil upon their beds, and then when it is morning, they put their evil plans into practice, because it is in the power of their hand to do so. They covet fields and take them. Simple as that. You want it, you get it, because you've got the clout. You've got the economic muscle. You've got the power and the influence, and the poor can't withstand you. You covet fields, you take them. You want houses, you take them away. And so he says, you oppress a man and his house, even a man and his inheritance. The very thing they weren't supposed to take, his land and his property, they took that as well. You read on, and you come to the story of Kings. You know the story in Kings, where Elisha went to a woman, a widow, and the widow was in great distress because she said, I have a lot of debt, and the debt collectors are going to come and take away my two sons to make them slaves. The sons, of course, were going to be used as slaves to pay off the debt. Now, we've seen in what we read earlier in Leviticus and those few quotes I made from Deuteronomy 24 that all of those things were illegal under the law. They were not allowed to take clothing in pledge. They were not allowed to take food or that which was used to make food. They were not allowed to take houses or property. They were not allowed to seize land. They were not allowed to sell people into slavery. And all of these things are happening. Now, of course, the disorders would not have existed if the people had have kept to the law of Moses, if they had have been obedient, and, of course, if they had have even kept the year of release. You remember, every seventh year, there was a year of release. Every seventh year, debts were cleared. And every 50th year, land reverted to the original owner. Incidentally, there was a proviso built into the law to make sure that the cost of things was reduced pro rata, so that you paid less and less as you got closer and closer to the 50 years, so that there was an element of fairness built into it. But also the provision was there to stop the wealthy and the powerful and the influential gobbling up everybody else. And so every 7th year and every 50th year, you had these provisos for the dissolution of any problems that were still hanging over. Now, in a simple agrarian economy, such as those people have, that was fair enough. It worked quite well. It was aimed, as I've said, to prevent exploitation of the disadvantaged or the vulnerable. But we, of course, live in a different sort of society. Now, we don't have that very simple type of economy. We don't live in that sort of society. You go into some countries of the world today and you may find there are still people living in the back blocks where money and a monetary system, such as we know, doesn't operate very well. It's not very important. And simple sort of provisos, such as we've seen here, may be enforced in one form or another. Now, we, of course, live in an entirely different economic system. We live in a very advanced, Western, technological, industrialized sort of society and sort of an economy. And you might have been thinking to yourself, well, is it wrong then to put your money out to gain interest on it? Well, I think quite obviously no. In fact, when you come to the New Testament, you find Jesus even gives a story on one occasion where he says, to one person, he said it would have been a good idea, in fact, if you had to put your money in the bank and at least got some interest on it, rather than doing nothing with it and leaving it lie there. Now, that is not in contravention of the law of Moses, because the law of Moses is not giving us laws concerning how we operate an economic system in the Western world. It's giving instruction to God's people, and I think those principles are still applicable to us. I don't think we're to ride the letter of the law with each other in our relationships. We are to be sympathetic. We are to be helpful. And the principle behind it, that we're a big family where each ought to help the other and not take advantage of the other, either the helper or the helped, neither should take advantage of the other. The principles are still there. But when we put our money in a bank or a building society or something like that, we're not helping out a poor person. In fact, I think they're very pleased to get our cash. In fact, they want to go and use the stuff to make a lot more of it for themselves. So they ought to pay us for it. I mean, they've got our money and they're going to go and do things with it. You see, that's a different system. Jesus, I think in that story that I referred to, I think he commended wise commercial investment, not at all in contravention of the law of Moses, because it's for a different principle. Somebody who wasn't poor, but rather wealthy, was wanting that money so that he could use it to make more for himself, and therefore he was obliged to give interest to the person who lent it. And so, fair enough, we go and put our money in some sort of financial institution. They're not poor, and they don't really need all our help to keep them afloat, so go for the best interest you can get. But what Jesus did condemn was greed. He condemned people who were greedy at the expense of others. In fact, we might go over and have a look at the New Testament in Luke chapter 6. Jesus now has some words to say about this whole idea of people exploiting others. Luke chapter 6. Take, for example, verse 30. Give to everyone who begs from you, and to him who takes away your goods, do not ask them again. Now you see, that is very consistent with what we have just read in the Law of Moses. Persons in need, don't exploit him because you see an opportunity for commercial advantage for yourself, but rather, he says, help him. But then in another context, in Luke in chapter 19, Jesus quite clearly approves of wise investment. You see, there is a difference in circumstances. What Jesus disapproved of was making money one's first concern, and particularly if a person did so at the neglect of those who are needy. I think of the story that Jesus told concerning the sheep and the goats, you know, in Matthew chapter 25, when the judgment comes and people are gathered before him, and then the sheep are separated from the goats. And you'll recall what he says there. To one, he says, you didn't feed me when I was naked, you didn't clothe me, I beg your pardon, you didn't feed me when I was hungry, you didn't clothe me when I was naked, you didn't give me something to drink when I was thirsty, you didn't visit me when I was in prison. And they said, when didn't we do this? And he said, insofar as you didn't do it to these, all these people you see around about you here, you didn't do it to others. Well, he says, as far as I'm concerned, you didn't do it to me. There are a lot of people who are living to look after themselves and totally neglectful of those who are in need. And that's the sort of thing that Jesus condemned. That's the same sort of thing he condemns here in chapter 6, when, for example, he says in verse 24, woe to you that are rich, for you have already received your consolation. It's the same sort of thing he says in Matthew 5 about those who pray in order to get the praise of men. He says, well, you get the praise of men now, but that's all the praise you'll ever get. You give lots of money and you do it publicly so that everybody's going to see and congratulate you. And he says, okay, that's your reward. You've had your reward. That's all the reward you'll get. Finished. He's saying again here, you wanted to fatten yourselves up and live on the best? Okay, he says, you've got it, you've enjoyed it, but that's all the enjoyment you're going to get. Woe to you who are rich now. He says, you've received your consolation. Okay, that's all. You'll get nothing else. Incidentally, I don't think he's talking here about wealth in itself being wrong. Obviously, what he's talking about are those who are living in luxury. In fact, I should have pointed out in Amos and also in Deuteronomy, in the two sections that I read, I missed out verses in both cases, where it referred to those who lived in luxury. And it referred also to the fact that the voices of the poor were crying out to God, and his ears heard. And he took note of how the poor cried out to him, and he took note also of how others lived in total neglect of the poor. If you read the Bible through, I don't think you'll find the Bible condemns wealth. What the Bible condemns is luxury, and that's quite a different thing. In fact, the Bible shows us quite often that God has great use for wealthy people. There are wealthy people that helped Jesus and helped the early church. In the Old Testament, you find people who are wealthy. It's not wrong in itself. But what is wrong is when people use it for themselves or when they go beyond what is reasonable. And luxury seems to me to be consistently condemned. In Timothy, when Timothy's to give instruction to people, when Paul gets around to talking about the wealthy, he doesn't say to them, tell them all they've got to throw it away and walk around in bare feet and eat orange peel and live in a bark hut. He doesn't say that to them. He says to the wealthy, tell them not to put too much stake on it, but to give it away and keep making more of the stuff so they can give a lot more of it away and so help a lot of other people. A very down-to-earth practical approach. But he says, don't use it simply to consume it upon your own lusts and passions. I think of some of the stories Jesus told. I think that's reflected in the story of Lazarus. You know, Lazarus, the chap, he was the beggar who picked up the bits of food that fell off the rich man's table. I think he sat actually out of the gate. He was full of sores and other horrible diseases. And eventually the two of them died. And when you have that conversation going on between Lazarus and the rich man, of course, has gone to a place of torment, and Lazarus is now in a place of peace and comfort. There's nothing in that about theology, nothing in about who believed the gospel and who didn't. I'm not saying that they may not have believed the gospel. All I'm saying is not in the story. But the story simply says, remember, O rich man, that you once received all the good things and Lazarus received all the bad things, but now, of course, you're in torment and he's in comfort. Because that rich man had seen that fellow at his gate day after day after day and walked past him, and it didn't mean that much to him. Just walked past him, ignored him. But you see, Jesus makes a point out of that, just as he made a point out of it in the story of the sheep and the goats. So here is a person who is quite comfortable himself and totally unaware and totally unaffected by the needs of others round about. Now that's what we saw in the law of Moses. He said, you've got to realize that you're a family. We are upset when others in our family suffered and we want to help them out. And that's what he's saying to the Israelites. He says, you should be one like a family. And when you see your brother in need, then he says, you aren't hard towards him, but you help him, and so on and so on. James has quite a bit to say about this, and he really gets stuck into these people whose sole aim in life is to make money. He says, woe to you who say, today or tomorrow we will go into such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and get gain. Whereas you do not know about tomorrow, what is your life? It's a mist that vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live, and then we shall do this, and then we shall do that. And when he's talking here about the Lord wills we should do this and that, I don't think he's simply saying that we use that as like an insurance policy. Some people talk about what they're going to do next week, and then they say, if the Lord wills. And often they sort of mean, provided I don't have an accident or break my leg or the house gets burnt down in the meantime. But I don't think that's what he's talking about. What he's talking about here is a person who's planning and doing everything without any thought of the fact that God ultimately is in control. And so all he's concerned about is going here and going there and expanding this and getting that and that, and he's going to build his business and get wealthier and wealthier. You see, I'm going to go here and go there. And he's not really worried about whether it's God's will or not. Whether God's in control of the future, whether he has faith in God to look after him, no, that doesn't enter his thinking. He's just got his eyes set on that. And James says, you ought to be saying, is it God's will that I should do that? And so we have to ask ourselves, is it God's will? It might be God's will that we should do this and have that project going. But at least you've got to determine that first and not live as if God doesn't matter. And what James is condemning here is personal advancement that leaves God out of its reckoning. And he then goes on to say, woe to you who rich, he says, weep and may the miseries come upon you. Your riches have rotted, your garments are moth-eaten. All the stuff they got stacked up. He says, you're not using it yourself, but you won't give it to anybody else so they can use it. And so it just rots and rusts. That, again, is the problem. Not simply the problem that they're rich, but the problem that they haven't used their riches to throw it away and give it to other people so that they can help them. They've lived in the fat of the land themselves. They've stacked it all up there so that it's of no use to anybody. And he says, what you should have done was spread it around among other people. Your riches have rotted, your garments are moth-eaten, your gold and silver is rusted, and you've laid up treasure for the last days. Then he says, the wages of your labourers, the people who work for you, the fellows who mowed your fields, he says, you kept back their wages. And the cries of those workers goes up to the ears of the Lord of hosts. That's a quote, incidentally, from Deuteronomy 24 that I read before. You've lived on the earth in luxury and in pleasure. There it is again, the word luxury. You've lived on the earth in luxury and in pleasure. You've fattened your hearts like animals for the slaughter. That's the sort of thing that Jesus was condemning. But it's the tendency of human nature, isn't it? It's the tendency for us to always go that way, to look after ourselves, look after number one, and then, unfortunately, the more substantial we become, very often we are tempted to be more neglectful of those who aren't so well off. Now, if we want to look at a personal application of this, let's flip over to Romans chapter 12. In Romans chapter 12 and Romans chapter 13, we have two cases which I think give us some sort of guidance concerning what our attitude should be towards giving and getting into debt. That is, our attitude towards A, getting into debt on the negative side, and our attitude B, towards giving to others and helping them on the positive side. In chapter 12, verse 13, contribute to the needs of the saints. Now, that's exactly what it said in the Old Testament. Well, not exactly, but you know what I mean. Help God's people, contribute to their needs. There are needy people among us. We tend not to think so in our affluent society, but there are needy people. And he's saying we've got to help those people. We've got to be hospitable to those people, which incidentally seems to be a dying grace among many of God's people. God's people, on the whole, are not very hospitable. We become very, very selfish. Very secure in our own way of life, and we've got it all worked out, our little plan, how our household and our family can run. Month comes and month goes, and apart from one or two maybe close friends or relatives that we more or less feel obligated towards, we aren't very hospitable. And the people who really lack fellowship, the people who have no friends, lots of people around here who don't really have any friends. In our own churches, there are people who really are lacking in friendship and fellowship. They're lonely at times. Well, here he's saying we are to contribute to the needs of God's people and we're to practice hospitality. We're to be generous and outgoing and outgiving. But there's another side to the coin in chapter 13, verse 8. And here he says, owe no man anything except to love one another, encouraging people not to get into debt. Now, I'm not going to go to town on this to an extreme. I realise that those of us who can buy a house without having to get it through some sort of financial institution are very, very, very few and far between. But in the general course of events, in the general run-of-the-mill way of life, surely we ought to be trying to take notice of this verse and live within our means, live a life of faith and accept what God gives us, and seek not to get ourselves unnecessarily into bondage to other people. That's chapter 13, verse 8. Now, this whole idea of debts, of being in bondage to somebody else, of getting into the power of another person, is now used in the New Testament in a doctrinal fashion. We saw what happened in the Old Testament. We started off in Leviticus and we saw the basic instruction concerning trying to avoid situations where needy people got into the grasp of unprincipled wealthy or powerful or those who wanted to exploit them for their own advantage. And then we looked on and we saw how that in fact had happened. And all the regulations that Moses had given were trampled underfoot by people who were out to line their own pockets at the expense of others. And so the vulnerable really fell under the control of these other people. And you see it very prominently when you go into third world countries. There's no doubt that the vast majority of people in many third world countries are very, very disadvantaged, and they are sitting shots for all these ruthless moneylenders. 10% per month is the sort of standard. Well, that's 10 years ago with inflation. I don't know what it is now, but in Thailand when we were there, 10% per month was the sort of standard loan shark deal. In fact, in some cases it was 10% per week. Interest is getting a bit heavy, isn't it, at 10% a week. But that's how people make their money, and you can see what happens is that once you've got a certain amount of money, you can just crush the people beneath you, and then you can take off. And then when the person is unable to pay back the debt, you can take some property from him in lieu. You can take that instead of the actual money. Or a person can work it off, and so he gets into your clutches then, working it off virtually without pay to pay off the debt. But the interest is so heavy that virtually what happens is all they do is ever pay off the interest, and they never seem to pay off the debt at all. And then comes along the person and he says, well, I really need it. And of course, he knows the person can't pay it. I'll take your house instead. You can keep your land, but I'll take the house. That becomes mine. And the chap has no option. And of course, it goes on one step after the other, and eventually the person gains the land as well. So that in so many countries throughout the world, you've got the situation where the bulk of the land is owned by a very, very, very small number of people. And once they've got into that position, they can virtually dictate everything and control the whole show. Now, that whole idea of getting into bondage, getting into the clutches of people, is developed by Paul in the letter to the Romans at some length. He uses it there in relation to the Christian, where the Christian is not to allow himself to get into the clutches of the old sinful human nature. Now, the old sinful human nature is likened to a tyrant, to a master, to somebody who will dominate you if you give him the chance. So you're not to make any provision for him. That old sinful human nature, if you don't keep him in his place, he'll get on top of you and he'll crush you and he'll bind you and you'll lose your freedom and your joy and your victory and everything else. And so Paul uses this illustration of debts and masters and slaves and freedom in Romans at some length. Now you can go right through chapter 6, 7, 8 and you'll find that that is the illustration behind a lot of Paul's teaching. Let's look at chapter 8 just for a couple of verses. And I think you'll see what we're talking about. He uses the word debtors. Well, in my Bible he does anyway. I'm using the RSV, incidentally. In chapter 8, verse 12, so then, brethren, we are debtors, not to the flesh. The flesh is the old sinful human nature, to live according to the flesh, because if you live according to the flesh, you'll die. But if by the Spirit you put to death the deeds of the body, then you shall live. So you can see there how he's drawing on this whole illustration of debts to get across a theological point. Now, most of the theology in the New Testament, and by theology I mean doctrine, where they're giving teaching concerning what Christians believe, most of it is based on illustrations. You see, this one here is based on the illustration of debts and loans and things of that nature. Redemption is based on the illustration, again, of slavery and then release from slavery. Justification is based on an illustration of a courtroom where a person is before a judge and he's either declared guilty or declared innocent, as the case may be. And then you've got adoption, which is another doctrinal issue that's based on an illustration of families where a son is adopted into a family and given the dignity and status of a son. And so one could go on and on. All these different doctrinal matters in the New Testament, nearly all of them come out of common everyday illustrations. Now, the common everyday occurrence being referred to here is that of getting into debt. And Paul says that the Christian is to realize that he owes the flesh nothing. A debtor owes his master everything, and he's in his clutches. He says, we don't owe the old sinful human nature anything. Christ has dealt with it, he's knocked it on the head, he condemned it on the cross, and we don't owe it anything. But of course we know that as long as we're alive, we'll still have that old sinful human nature. It's part of the imperfect world in which we live. Give it half a chance, and it'll come back and dominate us again. What he says is we're not to let it dominate us, because it has no right to dominate us. We have no obligation to it. We don't owe it anything. Well, don't let it dominate you. If I'm not in debt to that person, well, I'm not to submit to any rough tactics he comes to try to get me under his control. Now, the poor old debtor is under that man's control. And poor old debtor, he's there and he's very, very open to manipulation or to exploitation at this ruthless loan shark. But Paul says, we're not like that. He says, we don't owe it anything. So don't let it dictate to you. Look at it again. Brethren, we are debtors not to the flesh. We don't owe it anything. We are not debtors to it. So don't let it be our master. And of course in Romans 6 you have that developed at some length, but I'm not going to digress right now onto Romans chapter 6. What I would like to look at is just a few illustrations concerning how this debtorship is used by Jesus in a number of his messages and teachings. I've just got three that I want to refer to. The first illustration is when Jesus was in the house of Simon the Pharisee, and a woman who was a prostitute came, and she broke an expensive jar of ointment and she anointed Jesus' feet, and she showed her love and appreciation and gratitude in other ways as well. Simon was standing there and he was scandalized by this, because he was a Pharisee, and the Pharisees were the most righteous living people there were. They were paragons of virtue. Don't get the idea that the Pharisees were a bunch of scoundrels and scallywags and perverts and degraded debauchees or something like that. They weren't. The Pharisees, when you spoke of the righteousness of the Pharisees, that was the highest standard of righteousness that was around. And most people never thought they would attain to the righteousness of the Pharisees. They were top slot and had a degree of morality that they peddled that most people thought was beyond any realistic expectations of the multitudes. He was scandalized. I think Jesus, allowing a woman like that, rough character from the red light area down there, and here she is massaging his feet. And he said, if this man was a prophet, he'd know what sort of a woman she was. He wouldn't let her touch him. Ooh, don't you want that touching you? You see, he was shocked. And Jesus knew what was going on. He said, Simon, I've got something to say to you. And he said, look, I'll tell you an illustration. There were two people who were debtors. One owed a lot of money and one owed a little. Let's round figures for the sake of the illustration. Say one owed $500 and one owed $5. Neither of them had any cash, and when they couldn't pay, the master frankly forgave them both. Now, which of those two do you think would love the master most? Oh, obviously the one that was forgiven the greater amount of money. Precisely, said Jesus. Now, when I came into your house, he said, you didn't do anything really, did you? And he said, look at this woman. Okay, she's massaging my feet. But she doesn't know many other things. I mean, she's a prostitute. They don't have all that many skills, but one thing they are good at is massaging. And so she's doing the only thing that she really knows. And she's got this expensive load of ointment. She's massaging, she's crying, she's wetting the feet with her tears. He said she is so overjoyed at what she's been forgiven. She knew she was a sinner. She knew she was the dregs of society. And she's been forgiven this great debt. And so her love is just bubbling over. She can't express her love. It's so great because of the great debt that she's been forgiven. But he says, you don't think you need any forgiveness. You don't even think you're in debt because you're righteous already. The doctor can't help those who don't think they're sick. He said, I didn't come to call the righteous but sinners to repentance. You see how the illustration of debts comes through there. The second illustration is the one where Jesus is speaking of forgiveness. Matthew 18. There was a question asked by, I think it was Peter. One of them said, how many times should I forgive my brother when he does something wrong against me? Seven times? And then Jesus said, more than seven, 70 times seven. In other words, you just keep on forgiving and forgiving and forgiving without number. This is Matthew 18. Again, Jesus used an illustration of debts. He said there was one man who owed a great... Or let's just stick to the 505. We'll make the illustration simple. There was one man who had a debt to his master of $500. And he couldn't pay it, and so he went and pleaded mercy to his master. Please forgive me, I can't repay it. And the master, being a kind soul, said, okay, you're forgiven. Now this man went out then and he met a fellow servant who owed him $5. He says, you owe me $5, son, hand over. And the chap said, look, I haven't got it, and I've got five children, I'm out of work, and my wife's just been in hospital, and he went on with all this. And he said, I can't pay it. And the other character said, you pay me that $5? He says, or I'll have you thrown into jail. And when some of the other workers around the place heard of it, they went to the boss and they said, you know that chap that you forgave $500? And you said, wipe the debt clean, $500. Well, he went to another chap who only owed him a $5, and he said he screwed his neck to make sure he gave it. Whereupon the master said, bring him to me. So they brought the chap to him, and the master laid it on the line. He said, I forgave you all that, and you wouldn't forgive this little bit? He says, right, in clink, until you pay the lot. Then it finishes up with a very solemn note and says, so also will our Heavenly Father do to us if we don't forgive from the heart. And when I read that, it really sets me back on my heels. And I think we ought to take it seriously, because some of us Christians, we've sort of got the Bible worked out, and we've got all our assurance and our pat doctrines and ideas worked out. And I think sometimes we get too cozy and comfortable for our own good. We talk of assurance and so on, but very often what we're talking about, I think, is a sort of complacency. We're just taking it for granted. I believe we should be trusting in God's grace and have great confidence in God's grace, but I don't think we take God's grace for granted. If we do, then we're heading for trouble. And when I read that, I take it seriously, and if it makes me shudder and makes me a bit scared, then I think it's done precisely what Jesus intended it to do, because we are supposed to forgive each other. And if we have been forgiven this great debt by God, what sort of creatures are we if we can't forgive each other trifling little things that occur? And yet so often we can't. So often people are unforgiving, they get bitter, and little pin-pricking things occur, and then they major in people's view, and they find it so difficult to forgive. And yet at the same time, they claim that they have received this great forgiveness from God. We ought to take that lesson to heart and listen to the words of Jesus. So also will your Father do to you if you don't forgive from the heart your brother. And the final one is from the Lord's Prayer itself. In the Lord's Prayer, we are taught to pray for forgiveness. And the word that is used is once again debts. Lord, forgive us our debts. Or if you like, forgive us our trespasses or our sins. And so we are in our prayers to pray for forgiveness. But have you ever noticed there's a condition attached to it? And the condition is that we can expect God's forgiveness only as we are prepared to forgive those who've sinned against us. And if we're not prepared to do that, then I don't think we have any real confidence in coming to God and expecting Him to forgive us. Lord, forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors.